One Sunday afternoon in August 1965, as the Giants and Dodgers, two of baseball's most storied rivals, faced off during a tight pennant race, a fight broke out between Giants pitcher Juan Marichal and Dodger catcher John Roseborough. John Rosengren has written a new book about those two players and the night that changed their lives forever. It's called The Fight of Their Lives, How Juan Marichal and John Roseborough Turned Baseball's Ugliest Brawl into a Story of Forgiveness and Redemption. And I'm very pleased that it has brought John Rosengren back to our show. Hello.
Good afternoon, Leonard.
Is this book about baseball being a reflection of what goes on in America, or at least what was going on in America in the 60s?
It is. And even though it sounds cliche that sports mirrors societies, I think in this case it really is true. The turbulent times back in the 60s and those resulted in a moment of violence that we all remember.
Well, 1965, we tend to think of it as a time when baseball was fully integrated. But although Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in 47, the last team to integrate, the Boston Red Sox, did it in 1959. The Yanks signed Elston Howard just a few years earlier. So there still was a strong sense of racial separation in Major League Baseball.
Exactly. And even though Jackie Robinson had integrated baseball, he hadn't eradicated prejudice. And that prejudice was still lingering throughout the 60s. And after Robinson opened the doors for players from the Negro Leagues, he also opened the doors for dark-skinned Latinos to come to the United States. And so a lot of players got recruited from Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Dominican, and they faced extreme challenges coming here to the United States.
Manny Mendoza, who joined the White Sox in 1951 and is considered the first black player on the White Sox, he's Hispanic.
He's the Jackie Robinson of the dark-skinned Latinos. He debuted in 49 with the Indians and then made his mark with the White Sox, as you mentioned.
Well, so what about Juan Marichal and John Roseborough? They're both men of color.
Exactly, but they come from very different cultures as well. You know, you might say that I'm Caucasian and a Frenchman is Caucasian, but we both have quite different backgrounds and cultures, and so the two are not synonymous by any means. But
they're both like butter.
And good wine, I presume. But the fact that, the Latinos coming to the United States encountered racism that they hadn't known at home. I mean, there weren't Jim Crow laws in the Dominican. So it was quite a shock for Marichal to realize that he couldn't stay at the same hotel with his teammates or he couldn't eat in the same restaurants.
Even at this time in 65?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Jim Crow was still rampant. And even if it wasn't on the books in some areas, it was still a practice.
So how did that affect the way he felt about his adopted country? After all, he was considered pretty much a superstar. He was one of the great pitchers of his time.
Absolutely, and he had a tremendous debut in his first game in July 1960. He pitched a one-hit shutout, and Time magazine said it was the most amazing debut, you know, for years that anyone could remember. But he was, as you might imagine, you know, he's a young man coming to the United States. He doesn't understand the culture, doesn't speak the language, and so he's feeling homesick. He misses the music, he misses the food, he misses the customs that are familiar to him, and he doesn't speak the language, which is a formidable barrier. Then he encounters these racial attitudes that are completely foreign, and it's very upsetting. He was quite homesick.
So you say that prejudice against him and other Hispanics was double-edged.
Exactly.
Both on skin color and also on because they were immigrants.
Right. Their dark-skinned Latinos were deemed inferior because of their skin color and ignorant because they didn't speak the language or understand the nuances of culture.
Were people back in the Dominican Republic aware of this as a problem that Juan Marichal and others faced?
They had no idea. And Juan had no idea when he was coming to the United States what he'd encountered when one of the scouts early on, who was a Cuban, told him, "Don't date white women." He had no idea what the guy was talking about. I mean, that just seemed silly. But, of course, as you can imagine, the scandal it would cause if, in, say, Alabama or Mississippi, if Juan Marichal, a dark-skinned Latino, were driving around town with a white-skinned woman in his car.
Now, what was John Roseborough's background?
Roseborough grew up in Ashland, Ohio, which bills itself as the world headquarters of nice people. That's the sign that you see as you drive in from the interstate, welcoming you to town. And it was a town of nice people, 12,000 people, but only one black family, the Roseboroughs. And so John, while he had buddies and played sports and found a way to fit in socially, there were certain lines he couldn't cross. I mean, the Roseborough family wasn't being invited to other families' houses for Sunday dinner. John had a crush on a white girl and even dated her, but he knew he had to do so clandestinely in high school because of the scandal it would create. If people knew, even in that time, you know, in the 50s, that you were dating a white woman.
How did his teammates see him? Was he as nice as his town promised him to be?
He was a nice guy. He was a quiet guy. So his teammates naturally nicknamed him Gabby. He had a great wit. When he did speak, it was often something cutting and funny. He was a great competitor. He was real tough behind the plate. Buzzy Bavasi, the GM of the Dodgers, called him the Rock of Gibraltar. But he wasn't as tough in real life as he might have aspired to be or thought he was. His wife and his daughter both told me that he was a gentle person on the inside.
He was the Dodgers catcher, following in the tradition of one of the greatest of all the African-American catchers, Roy Campanella.
Exactly. I would claim he is the greatest African-American catcher and one of the greatest all time, up there with Yogi Berra and Johnny Bench. But Campanella had mentored Roseboro. Roseboro was called up in 1957, midway through the season, the last year the Dodgers were here in town and playing at Ebbets Field. And Campanella had taken Roseboro under his wing, become a mentor, and even a second father to him. And Roseboro said he loved him dearly. So it was with great sadness that he heard the news in January 1958 about Campanella being paralyzed. And then he felt tremendous pressure to fill the shoes of this three-time MVP.
Some of the teams, as I said, integrated rather late. The Yankees with Elson Howard very late, even though they were New York.
1955.
Boston, the worst, 1959. Mm-hmm. But was there still racial prejudice on a team like the Dodgers, despite the fact that Robinson had broken the color line in 47?
The Dodgers were one of the more welcoming teams. There were certainly racial tensions on other teams, but the Dodgers were one of the early teams. And, you know, we know the story famously of Pee Wee Reese welcoming Robinson, while others like Dixie Walker didn't want to play on the same team. Though I think Walker was simply reflecting the attitudes of the day, a guy coming from the South, and he was worried people wouldn't come to his hardware store if he played with a black man. There were tensions on other teams, and there were, interestingly, tensions drawn or lines drawn between the African-American players, the Latinos, and the whites. And so on teams like the Giants, there was a lot of racial division.
They had integrated fairly early with Monty Irvin, hadn't they?
Exactly, and then had Willie McCovey, Willie Mays, and then players like Orlando Cepeda, Felipe Alou, Juan Marichal. But it got to the point where Alvin Dark, the Giants manager, said he banned Spanish in the clubhouse. And one of the Twins players, who had an American-born Caucasian who had seven Latin teammates, said they should be speaking American, because he didn't understand what they were saying, and many of the non-Spanish-speaking teammates felt paranoid that they were talking about him.
My guest is John Rosengren, whose latest book is The Fight of Their Lives, How Juan Marichal and John Roseboro Turned Baseball's Ugliest Brawl into a Story of Forgiveness and Redemption. Now, the Giants and Dodgers had this rivalry because they were two New York teams, the only city that had two teams in the same league.
Actually, three, if you count the Giants, the Yankees, and the Dodgers.
No, I said in the same league.
Oh, same league. You're right. Yeah, okay, only two, if you count them that way.
But then they left and went to L.A. and San Francisco. Did the rivalry diminish a bit?
People thought it might because of their move across the country, but actually the distinct personalities of those two cities, Los Angeles and San Francisco, contributed to the rivalry, and it continued to thrive out on the West Coast. And so whenever these two teams met, whether it was here on the East Coast or out on the West Coast, there was an intensity to those games beyond the regular contest.
And now we're talking about 1965. In Los Angeles, that's the year of the Watts riots.
Exactly. These were turbulent times throughout the world. We had the Vietnam War going on. There was a civil war in the Dominican Republic and the Watts riots. And prior to this, the Dodgers-Giants also locked in this tight pennant race going down late summer 1965. Had a four-game series in Candlestick Park late August. And just the week before, the Watts riots had occurred. And so John Roseboro, this black man living in South Central L.A., has watched the smoke rising from the buildings to the south while he's playing games at Dodger Stadium, and he's wondering, why are we still playing baseball when the racial tensions have reached this point in America?
But he wasn't the only black player on the team.
Not at all.
Maury Wills, in fact, was, you know, one of the great shortstops of all time.
Sure.
There were a number of other
African-Americans. Lou Johnson, Jim Gilliam, of course. So he wasn't alone, but he was, as a black man, very troubled by what was happening. And someone who hadn't really shown a concern about racial issues to that point, it suddenly hit home from him. And it took a very personal turn the night that the protesters were scheduled to march down the street in front of his house. He sat up on his front stoop that night with a loaded gun, ready to protect his family, unaware of what was going to happen with the violence. So he was quite on edge, as you might imagine, going into that series.
And you say Marischal was as well because of the Civil War going on back in the Dominican Republic.
Exactly. President Johnson had committed 20,000 troops to this conflict in the Dominican Republic. And so Marischal was watching the evening news, seeing these bloody battles being fought on the streets of Santo Domingo, literally worried sick about his family's
but
safety.
But can we say that that spilled over into this game? This game sounds to me like the sort of thing that we have seen over the years. Marischal had flattened Maury Wills early in the game. And then Sandy Koufax, pitching for the Dodgers, throws one really close to Marischal. That's the kind of thing that was more common then than it is today. But there are, I think, Keith Hernandez of the Mets broadcasters says he wishes the brushback was more common today because he thinks that that's a good strategy.
That's easy to say from the broadcaster's booth. No, but I would
he was
agree.
A good batter.
I understand. And I would agree with you that, you know, brushback pitches have been part of the game.
Well, Sal Magley had played for both the Dodgers and the Giants, and they used to call him the barber because he would throw so close to people's heads.
Exactly. And he tutored Don Drysdale with the Dodgers, who has the all-time record for most batters hit. And I think, sure, it's safe to say that these events could have occurred in any game. But I also think it would be naive to not recognize what was going on in these two men's lives at the time that contributed to the event, because these guys are humans first, right? And so they bring their emotions, and as much as you might want to have people say, well, they when they step on the ball field, they become ball players and they leave everything else behind. I mean, Marischal told me it was very hard to be thinking about baseball on the mound when he's worried about his family's safety back home.
Meanwhile, we have this brushback from the great Sandy Koufax, but that's not what precipitated this. It was John Roseboro's throwing the ball back to Koufax?
Exactly. As you mentioned, Marischal had knocked down two Dodger batters, Ron Fairley and Maury Wills. Koufax had thrown a retaliatory pitch over the head of Willie Mays, and the home plate umpire had warned both benches, any more brushbacks, and I'm going to eject the pitcher. So when Marischal came to bat in the bottom of the third, baseball's code called for Koufax, the pitcher, to throw at him. But because the umpire had warned them—
Chad Crawford, one of the great umpires.
Exactly. They didn't want to lose their star pitcher that early in the game in this critical contest, so Roseboro told Koufax, let me take care of it. So he deliberately dropped the ball, stood up, took a step inside, and threw the ball back past Marischal's face. Marischal said it came so close it nicked his ear. Now, if you think about that for a minute, a guy humming a ball past your head from 3 feet behind you while you're not looking, I mean, that's very startling. So Marischal turned. He's shocked. He's angry. He's frightened. And then he sees Roseboro coming at him in his full catcher's gear, mask included. Marischal took a step back and brought the bat down on Roseboro's head. And not to excuse at all in any way what Marischal did. He'd be the first to say that was wrong to strike Roseboro as he did. But I think it helps us understand why he acted as he did, knowing the context.
And what was the reaction? This was in the Giants' ballpark.
It opened a 2-inch gash in Roseboro's head and set off this 14-minute brawl.
And both plays, both teams, the players got involved. What was the fallout of the fight for Marischal? Was he then seen as some kind of a brute because he had done that?
I imagine many of your listeners can picture that photograph, the famous photograph of Marischal with his bat raised over Roseboro's head, which we use as the cover of the book. And from that, you know, cast Marischal as the villain, Roseboro as the victim. Roseboro, of course, did provoke the incident by throwing the ball back.
And he fought back, didn't he?
He did, and he landed a good punch. Roseboro's probably biggest regret from that day was that he didn't land more than one solid punch. But the fallout for Marischal was he was fined $1,750, which doesn't seem much by today's standards, but it was a record amount at the time. He was suspended for 10 playing dates, and he when he came back in 65, he wasn't the same pitcher. So it may have cost the Giants the pennant.
But what was Marischal like off the field? Was this a reflection of the kind of character he had?
You know, as much as people wanted to cast him in the role of the stereotypes of this hot-blooded, tempered Latino prone to violence, he was actually had this cheerful disposition. His nickname was Laughing Boy. He had a cherubic smile and a penchant for practical jokes. He was also a family man, married with two small children at the time, and a devout Catholic. He would pray the Psalms at night. He would go to church on Sunday mornings. You know, even when the team was on the road, he'd find a place where he could go to Mass. So this was a moment where I think he was caught up in the heat of the moment, and as I said, troubled by the times, and behaved in a way that he wouldn't ordinarily have. And it and probably the biggest consequence for him was how it haunted him and how he felt immediately guilty.
Do you think it kept him out of the Hall of Fame?
Absolutely. I mean, he had the record and the stats to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, and so but he received a little more than 50% of the vote on his first round because the baseball writers were remembering this incident and how it tarnished his reputation. Second time round, he didn't get in again. And so, yes, I think it did.
But finally forgiven, he had to be in the Hall of Fame.
Exactly.
And what was Roseboro's reaction when he joined the Dodgers in 1975? Had they forgiven each other at that point?
They hadn't. They had not completed their reconciliation at that point. And so Roseboro had hoped that the Los Angeles fans would give Marshall a chance. Of course, he pitched his two games not well, and Marshall then said he couldn't take the owner's money anymore, and he retired.
But your subtitle is, it turned the baseball's ugliest brawl into a story of forgiveness and redemption.
Well, after Marshall didn't get in the second time, he called up Johnny Roseboro, who was running a PR firm in L.A. at the time. He said, "Johnny, I need your help." And Roseboro had carried his own guilt for having let Marshall take the heat and the blame for this moment. And so I think he was ready to help. He went down to the Dominican Republic, played in a celebrity golf tournament that Marshall hosted. They held a press conference. The two of them posed for pictures. And they said, "Listen, we've put this behind us, and I think you should too." And then Marshall got in on the next vote. But I think most significantly what happened during that week is these two men who had been forever linked as antagonists realized, even though they didn't have much in common, that they liked one another, enjoyed one another's company, and they did find some common ground. And Marshall apologized. Roseboro forgave him. And Marshall told me that he felt this weight lift from his body.
Where does Marshall live now?
He splits his time between the Dominican and Florida.
John Rosengren's book is called The Fight of Their Lives, How Juan Marichal and John Roseboro Turned Baseball's Ugliest Brawl into a Story of Forgiveness and Redemption, although many years later, 1983. The book is published by Lions Press. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
You're welcome, Leonard. Thanks for having me.